Our next speaker is Christian Kinnick. He's got a long history in LISP and the success of LISP. He was the chairman of the ISO committee standardizing ISO LISP, and that was quite a delicate job. It was like a UN ambassador's role in cooling down the tribes, the warring tribes. So that was a wonderful job he did. I also was invited by him to go in on a PhD jury in Paris one time because several of his students were doing research in LISP and compilers for LISP, and one of them had a very interesting project similar to what I'd done myself. So there is quite a history of LISP here, and right now he's a dean in the academic ladder of administration and teaching computer science to undergraduates. So this is our future. Hopefully we will still have some place left that teaches things like structure and interpretation of computer programs again. So let's hear what happens at University of Paris 6 from Christian Kinnick.
Thank you. First I want to apologize for my English because since I was not exactly a dean but an administrative responsible for the license, I would explain what is license in France. For the past 6 years, I have not practiced English for many, many years. So this is the dark side of research teaching. I will concentrate on three topics, not to bore you too much. Teaching, personal coaching, and grading en masse. It's a real English name, so nice. I try to avoid the titles with funny names from English coming out from French, but I did not succeed in fact. So, age and diploma are definitely related also. Maybe you know that the Ministry of Education, of National Education in Europe, decided on the Bologna Declaration to unify all the diplomas in university. So now we have, in fact, two diplomas, which are called the bachelor degree and the master degree. And here I put the time scale in years from the birth of the student. So in France, he got the baccalaureate normally at 18. And then he got what we call the license, which is, in fact, the bachelor degree in English speaking. We don't use the bachelor degree because someone who has the baccalaureate in France is called a bachelier, which translates to bachelor, if not a bachelor degree. So here you have the three main things, the baccalaureate, the license at 21, and the master. And so we have to put all our educational system topsy-turvy and to try to figure out how to converge, because we have to implement the Bologna Declaration by 2010. So here is the situation at UPMC, which is the University of Pierre and Marie Curie, formerly known before as Paris 6. We have three main ways in the first year. The first one, which is mainly biology and physics. The second one, which is, as you say, physics, chemistry, mechanics, and electronics. And the last one, which is a more abstract one, with math and informatics. The figures in red are the number of students which are coming at the beginning of the year at the university. So we have 800 students coming for math and computer science at the beginning at UPMC. The first year we don't have any grasp on it. It's a kind of mix where you have to study maths, informatics, and many, many other things. And you are able, in fact, to choose the kind of diploma you want, that is, a license or a bachelor degree in maths or in computer science only at the end of the first year. So we have, in fact, the red figures which are there. We have 150 students that choose mathematics degree, 150 that choose computer science degree, and 200 students in the middle who have not yet decided between maths and computer science, and which, in fact, defer their choice until the end of the second year. And at the end, this is the numbers in red at the right. We have 200 bachelor degree in computer science, 200 in math, and 50 in a new bachelor degree, which is called math and computer science, which is a mix with equal part between math and computer science. It's the only bachelor degree in France which have a business of two disciplines. So, computer science, and I will be brief, have a rich catalog of computer science course, and you see that during the first year we have 3 courses, second year 11, and third year 28, so we have a rich catalog, and I will explain why we have such a rich catalog. But we have in fact two incompatible goals. That is, at the end of the bachelor degree, the students have two choices, or to go to the workplace, and then they must be bankable, that is, they must have a real competence to enter some enterprise, or they pursue and try to get the Master of Computer Science. And in that case, what is interesting in the bachelor degree is just to give them the basis for pursuing studies. So we have these two kind of things, and one reason we have such a big catalog is to offer the students kind of professionalizing courses in the third year, or theoretical basis to continue. So, what are at the end, we should go to the Hollywood, that is, which languages are taught. So here I just put the mostly taught, that is, at least 200 students in the university. So here are the choices. In first year, they are all exposed to Scheme, and then to Visual Basic for Excel, and there is an optional course in Maker. In second year, we expose them to CAMEL, which is a functional language in the line of ML, C, Java, assembly for 86. Yes, we have still 86 at the university, and some shell programming. And the third year, we have ADA, assembly programming for a MIPS in an architecture course, computer architecture course. Of course, SQL, then Bash again, Java again, OCaml again, and so on and so on. So these are the main languages we teach. Why we have such a rich catalog? In fact, we think there are two reasons. The first one is that for good students, to be exposed to more than one language, that is, you can envision the bachelor degree as a Java certification, for instance, and so you just have to expose to one language, that does everything. So we expose to a number of languages because we think that if you don't grasp one language, you can grasp another language. And for instance, we have students that don't understand anything to Scheme, but understand something to Visual Basic, and we have the other way around also. So we expose to many different languages in order to capture all these students. So this is for the bad students. For the good students, to be exposed to more than one language allows them, in fact, to synthesize the many common parts of all these languages and to be better. So the bad have at least more than one chance to get something, and the good one have plenty of chances to get real things. So here are the scientific studies in the first year of UPMC. So there are 4 mandatory courses in maths, 2 mandatory courses in computer science, but most of the students take a third one. And we have here the format for all of the lectures because we have courses, pre-lab sessions, and sessions. Okay, enough of that. So what are the constraints of the first introductory course to computer science? So in 98, I was given the responsibility of this first introductory course. So I have to convince my colleagues first that I want, in fact, to teach something interesting. So we have a lot of students. Remember that we have 800 students. So it's a kind of Napoleonian organization, you know, with one responsible, 4 amphitheater lecturer, 24 group responsible, 24 what we call the shadow, teaching assistant, okay? So it's a real Napoleonian organization with a coordinator that just take 4 groups and ensure that they all progress the same pace, etc., etc. The other constraint is that all these students, as you see the figures, are not bound to become bachelor to get a bachelor degree in computer science. So in fact, we have general scientific students. 50 of them will go in mechanics. 15 of them will go in electronics, 200 in computer science, and 200 in mathematics. So we have to be able to teach what is computer science. And we want to introduce computer science as a science, not a technology, to introduce, to attract students toward computer science, because if they don't go to computer science, they will go to maths or to mechanics and so on, and we have to have a number of students. And we have also many students which have various level of computer skills. You know, we have big guys that know how to set up the jumper on the motherboard cord to get the IRQ correct and so on and so on. And we have also shy little girls that have good nut in maths but never touch a computer, or at least never open a computer. So, what we proposed was a new course, which was called the Recursion and Evaluation Process, and I will focus on it. So the Recursion and Evaluation Process is clearly something which is encouraged by the ICP, the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programs, the big book from MIT. We just concentrate on recursion, on numbers, on lists, on trees, and the reason to concentrate on recursion is that first, the students were exposed the previous year to recurrence in mathematics, and recursion and recurrence have some definite links. And the second reason is that they don't know, all of them, what is recursion. So it's a way to introduce them to something weird, to something new, to something intriguing. And we just put the emphasis on recursion for 8 weeks, and then we skip to grammars, which are the pending side of trees, and then we just finish the last course by saying, well, all we did on numbers, on lists, on trees, and on grammars, then you just have to gather them, and you can have the evaluation process in Scheme, that is eval in Scheme, written for Scheme. And this is the cherry on the top of the cake. Of course, to have this program, there is only one language to do it, which is Scheme. I think I tried to figure out the number of courses around the world which are based on ICCP, and with such a largest number of students, and I think that we are the largest in the world such course. So, what is interesting is that what is in our subset of Scheme we are teaching. So it's purely functional. We have a very little set of special forms, define if, quote, let, and that's are. And we have some derived forms, cond, or, and begin. Begin is only used when you want to trace inner definitions, as you will see in a few moments. We also use a functional graphical library from concrete abstraction. The graphical library is not a tortoise one, it's something like you just compose expressions, you compose triangles to make stars, you compose stars to make, I don't know, a kind of line of stars, for instance. So you just compose things, because the functional programmation is just about composing expressions. So you just draw by composing drawings. And this is the reason for which we take this library. And all in all, we have, in fact, they are exposed to these special forms and only to 70 functions. So we have a quick reference card. Here is a view of it. Okay, you see the grammar of the dialect. You see the grammar of the comments, special comments. We see the grammar of the libraries, and there is another sheet of paper, which is this this one. And we say that this paper, in fact, represents the whole course. And you have even the right to take it to the exam. Fair. So, I don't know how to return to the presentation, so I use this hatch. Then, what is interesting also is what we don't take in our subset in Scheme. So we refuse to take macros, which are complex, no continuations, no input output, no side effect, In fact, in eval, you have a hidden side effect to do the look for letterec, because the environment must know the function that know the environment, and you cannot, or you just use Y, the paradoxical combinator, and which is clearly out of scope. Or you use a vector set somewhere to just fit the loop. So we have no lambda. Scheme without lambda? Yes. Scheme without lambda. We made a lot of experiments, and we figure out that these students at this age don't have have many problems manipulating things which don't have a name. So we just force any students to name the things they use. So if you want to have lambda, you just create a define, and then you return the name of that function. So you name it, and you use that name. And in fact, it's many people, in fact, don't have any problems creating inner functions and returning an inner function which is named. And if you use lambda, they have a lot of problems for that. I don't know why. Maybe there is some psychological theory behind it. But once we take once we remove lambda and we force students to name things, we don't have any problem. And we don't have any dotted pair. So counts take an element and a list of element and just return a list of element. If you see a dot somewhere in your print, then you have a mistake somewhere. It's clear and simple. Okay, we have a lot of conventions. For instance, we refuse to debug programs of students which are not pretty printed correctly. We enforce some naming conventions. We enforce that the structure comment before any functions where you have the subtype of the function which is clearly expressed. We enforce contractor verification contract for each function, that is, what they take, what they must signal, what they should assume before entering the function, and so on and so on. We enforce all students to write tests for their functions, and students love make tests, of course. And we also have a strong emphasis on abstraction barrier, saying that the way you can grow your programs is to have a correct abstraction barrier. So here it is time to show a kind of examples. Here, so you see that we have the structure comment with the type of a function in front. So this kind of function is clearly done something at the 8th or 9th week on a cursus of 12 weeks. Okay, so you see that we have an internal function, and we have here a kind of lambda, which is just to name result x and to return result as a function. Okay, that's enough. Now, the example continued. Since we are enforced to write the test, we just introduce a macro, but students don't know for sure that it is macro, verify, which says I have to verify the iterate function, and then I just give some examples, and the answer which is expected. So, here is the example. So, we teach that course since 1999, so this makes a huge number of thousands of students which are exposed to that subset of skill. We have a big management effort. In fact, the most important effort was in fact with our colleagues. And so we have a course, we made a course for our colleagues 1 year before teaching in front of the students. And we wrote a lot of things, exercise, solution to exercise, and so on. So this has an interesting effect, which has, we have a lot of memorabilia. That is, we have the course, which is written. We have the annals with the solutions. We have another book of exercise, but all are in French, sorry. and I have a revised version of my book in French, of course. So. One interesting effect is that this course, in fact, it has an equalization effect, because no students were exposed to Scheme before, and the one who know how to set their ARQ or know something like Visual Basic and so on, they are all equalized. And this favors women, in fact. It has a nice effect, because if you see that we are in a kind of functional language, pure functional language, this is all maths or just symbol rewriting. And the women which are very competent in mathematics after the baccalaureate, in fact, have no problem going into that kind of science. It explores computer science as a science because we operate, in fact, in a very poor and very shallow environment. We have a few concepts only. We don't enter the complexity of languages such as C++ or Java and so on. And we have this kind of theory of impregnation, I don't know if you know it. That is, we try, in fact, to show the students, without saying it, good habits, things that should be normal, things that should be expected everywhere. For instance, if you just say, well, I will compute the fraction 1/100th by taking the factorial of 1990 and then dividing it by the factorial of 100, you get exactly 1/100th. So we see big numbers and we see a precise result. You don't have to make a fuss about it. You just show it can be. Okay, you just compute. So after that, when they go to integer with 32 bits and so on, and they see that the reality, in fact, is far more complex, they say, oh, well, but I was exposed to something which was good, sensible, etc., etc. And at the end, of course, the cherry on the cake is something that delights a few number of students. So you just mark them or blame them, and 5 years after, you have them in PhD. So, let me skip to the personal coaching. After this course, the next year, we were in 2000 or 2001, we just tried to set up an environment where students can work, scheme anywhere, anytime, and even if they are not internet connected. So what we have is we embed a web server in Dr. Skins for quizzes. So I will talk a little after a bit of quizzes. And we have also an automatic grader, that is you just type your exercise and you have an automatic grader that says, well, your exercise is good or not so good, or it just is 2/20, I don't know how you mark it, but or you have an A+ or a B-. So, let's talk a little about quizzes. Quizzes generally are often seen as a kind of choice between many choices, or you just have to click on several choices and so on and so on. What we introduce is that is elaborate quizzes. For instance, we have quizzes like, what's the value of that expression? And so you just have to type the value. This is an easy one. We have also some quizzes like, give me an expression whose value is. So it's a kind of inverse of eval. So you have to figure out which programs can give that value. Of course, what's the type of config? And the last, penultimate is, give me a context where this expression will return that value. Or give me given that context, give me an expression giving that value, and so on and so on. So we have this kind of elaborate quizzes to tease the students. Of course, they use web continuations, but I do not intend to speak about web continuations today. Exercise. So exercise is a different kind of exercise. What we want is to set up a specification and have the students just work and try to figure out how to implement this specification. So instead of having something like a web server and to type something into the web forms in Firefox and so on, we decided in fact to graft the exercise in a real programming environment. So we choose Dr. Scheme and we had a menu and a button in order for the students to be in a real development environment. So with real tools, debuggers, and so on and so on. The thing you have to be acquainted with if you want to develop really. And what we added is that whenever the students believe that he has finished to implement the specification, he just wants to say, well, I want to be graded, or marked or whatever. And the answer pops, and he say, well, you have done a good job, or it's a fair job, or it's a really disgusting job. So we have 60 exercises. Most of them have between 2 to 5 questions, so we have something like 200 or 300 specifications to be implemented. And we, of course, recommend a series of exercises to the students. So here is the principle of automatic grading, but before that, I want to show you how it works. So let me see. How do I go to... Sorry. This I don't want. I want to go to the other part. I put it on the other desktop window, but sorry, I don't know how to do it. Maybe this. Yeah. So here is the Dr. Scheme environment. You have the edition window on top, and you have the evaluator on the bottom. So here, I just decide to take an exercise of the first season, like the American TV series. Then we go on the simple exercise on list, or no, recursion, linear recursion, yeah, and we take the, let's sum the element of a list of numbers. Okay, yeah, okay. So here we have the template, and here we have the first question that says, well, this exercise is just to compute some numbers. So we go to the first question. And the first question say, well, if you have that list, you should return 17, and if you have an empty list, you should return 0. So here you say, well, I just define the sum of a list, and I say, okay, this is 0. And I say, well, check it, grade me. I want to grade the sum list because there are a number of functions. Oh, we say, well, you got 2 over 20. But it's red, so it means that it's not fair enough. So it says that some functions are not defined. Oh, some list. What oh, yeah, yeah, yes. For? The reason is that we ask for a function named sum list, not sum. Okay, so let's try to fix this thing and say, well, check it again. Oh! 5! Yeah, I'm a master. So I say, well, okay, and he says, well, but you have not defined any test. So I refuse. Okay, let's do some tests. So it's called vérifier in France. So I verify some list, and I say that some list of null is in fact 0. Okay, let's check. Sorry? Oh, yes. Okay. But... No.
Verifier.
No. Oh, sorry. Yeah, verifier. Of course. You should have said
French is
a I'm mixing all the languages. Oh, green, green. You know.
Whoa!
Whoa!
Okay, but it says that all the functions of the students are not correct with respect to the teacher's test. Of course, I've cheated. Okay, I say that the sum of list is always a constant 0, and I only try on an example which effectively returns 0. So you see the thing, and then when you are over some threshold, you get a solution, and then you can continue and proceed.
So this is a passing grade.
it's a subgrade. Yeah. I think this exercise is given at the third week or fourth week, something like that.
But in fact, you should have 0 for that indentation.
Okay, so
that's also a matter.
Let's get to another topic. So I just returned to the slide. Yeah. So how we do it, how we grade? So it's very simple, in fact. So first, we check that F and verify F do exist. Then we have some syntactic checks on F, that is the correct arity, it's really a function, and so on and so on. Then we just test the coherence, whether the test that the student wrote were in fact where the function F satisfies the test he wrote. Then we take the teacher's F and we just input it into the test of the students. And we check here that he doesn't write any something which is coherent, but which is not related to the specification. And then we take the student F and we check it against the verified F of the teacher. And then you get some numbers, you just mix them, and you get a mark. And you record it in a database, and so, and you put green or red where. So this is really simple, but what we observe are two effects. The first one is that students don't read the solutions unless there are more than one solution. It's really curious, but in fact you can explain it. If you give two solutions to an exercise, they are intrigued because they say, well, there are two solutions. But in fact, remember, until that age in mathematics, there is only one demonstration. You may have some little variance because if you have something commutative, you can fix some part and some other part and be commutative. But there are variants on the same demonstrations. And they are really intrigued that we can ask them for some problems which have more than one solution. And in that case, they read the solution to understand why there are two solutions. So we, in fact, introduce a lot where we can of alternating solutions just to fix that. The other effect, which is an interesting one, is we had many discussions on the red and the green thing. When do we show the solution to a student? Do we show it until all the tests pass, that is, he has 20 over 20, A plus, or do we show it until he has, I don't know, A or B plus? I don't know if B plus exists, but you take the idea. We decided on B plus, because if a student doesn't make the effort to be completely satisfying, then he will be stricken back at the next exercise, because we, in fact, have other questions. And these questions, in fact, are supported by the fact that the previous question is good. And so if the previous question is not good enough, there are the new questions where the problem may be in the new questions or in the old questions. And in fact, in a very intimate way, we instigate the idea that you should test thoroughly. And if you don't, you will be striking back at the next exercise. So after that, after days, if you go this way, you train students to write their test and to check completely their functions before going on the other questions. So technically, all these things are based on eval, of course. It requires a strict isolation of the teacher's code and the student's code. You cannot just use a package name to say a teacher F or a student F, because there is at that time an obvious solution to write a student F of X. You just call teacher F of X, of course. So in fact, all the teacher's functions are compiled, and compilation is a clear obfuscation of the code. We have some future work for a long number of years, and we expect to do it in some years, to check whether the dialect of scheme is completely respected, to have a more specific comments on part of the code, to look at the style of the code, and so on and so on. So these exercises are used on a regular basis every day during the first semester, where the students are exposed to scheme. The students work at their pace, and once again, in fact, the good one become better because they can go straight through and very quickly through all the exercise. And the bad one, in fact, just attire the attention of the teachers so they can work with them in order to be more profitable. The medium students have clearly a problem at that time.
The students may work at home, but the experience says that they don't work at home. And one thing which is interesting is that we have a database of thousands of solutions, and we think someday when we have time, to data mine all these things in order to understand the type of errors which is repeatedly made by the students. So, the last part of my talk will be grading en masse. It was done, in fact, for courses at the third year, so the final year of the bachelor degree. And we elaborate this grading en masse on the experiment I just told you on the Dr. Skim experiment. We want, in fact, to have examinations performed on computer, because we think that if you are a computer scientist, then it seems normal to have examinations on computers. You cannot imagine, for instance, a drawer which takes drawing courses and who want to have a drawing bachelor degree and go into the examination room and we say, well, take a pen and write a dissertation on how you would make an imitation of Ingres, for instance. No, you just say, take this pencil, take this model, and just draw it. So why in computer science we are bound, in fact, to make dissertations on the way we can take to make some programs rather than programming? So we decided, in fact, to have a real hands-on keyboard examinations for some courses. The problem is that we had 200 or 300 students at the time, and to have this number of copies and programs is clearly something really exhausting. So we wanted, in fact, to automatically grade these copies. This has very interesting consequences. The first is that you are sure that you uniformly grade the copies of students. No more effect like the first copies, you say, well, it's not possible to be so dumb. And also the effect at the end of the day, after the 350 copy, well, I don't understand why they are so dumb. But in the first case, you just give zero, and at the end, you just give 10 because you are sick. So here, you have a very uniform grade. The second is that since this is all computerized, you have the marks on the network, you have the copies of the graded works on the network, and so on and so on. You just have to switch your figures. And the last effect, which is the interesting one, is that we have dynamic persistence analysis. That is, 4 years after, you can take the same examinations that they took and be graded exactly as they were. So for instance, in 50 years, when you say that the level is decreasing year after year, you will take your student, take this analysis, and say, well, let's see. Okay, wait 50 years. So grading is still based on black box tests. It requires, in fact, very, very precise specification of a problem, because if you make a mistake in the specification, you will have 300 copies to fix. Okay, and the cost is clearly exhausting. You have, in fact, also to describe exactly the grading process. Most students say, well, and if the inputs are not conformant to the specification, what should I do? And they say, it's written. You don't have to care, because it's written that the test will be with correct input and so on and so on. So you have to be very clear of the grading process, what you will grade exactly. Of course, it should be, the student's code should run on confined machine, because they are looping programs, they are blocking programs that block on some weird input they expect for a long time, and we have a few minority of malicious programs. So you have, in fact, to take a lot of care for this code you never know. So, what we learned during this exercise, we did it for four years now, and we have 10,000 of copies graded automatically now. You should be very progressive in the scale of a grading. That is, you must not give for a question 1 or 0. No. You should give 100th of point for that. And if you succeed this thing, you give 200 200th of point, and so on and so on. You have to dilute the marking in many, many different fractions, the sum of which gives the total. You should produce a very copious verbalization of what you are grading. Most students at the first time say, well, you tell me that I have, I don't know, 8 over 20 or a C minus. I want to see my copy. And I say to the student, well, your copy is what you gave me. It's the TGZ you have somewhere on your computer. And you say, well, no, I don't want my input files. I want my copy, my graded copy. Well, so we, in fact, verbalize all the things we did. So we say, for instance, here is your program. And you just show the program. Here is my input. Here is what I expect. Here is what I get. Here you see that they are clearly different. Okay, and I put a diff, a color diff somewhere. And you say, well, you see, I cannot give you more than 100th of point on that field, etc., etc. And the more copious you are, the less reclamation you have. When you give a copious verbalization of 800K, then most students don't go to the end because they are exhausted too. Never ask questions with an answer like yes or no. For instance, is P equal to T? No. Don't test this question. Because if you have either students, the smart students, and after month after month we had smart students say, I just have to write a program that say yes every time. Since you will probably have tests requesting a yes answer and a number of tests probably equal requesting the no answer, if you have a program that say always yes, you get half of the points. So you should always enter something that vary. For instance, I don't know, give me the date and the answer yes or no, or something like that. No random checks. We had some 4 years ago a question like, you should pick three words in this list, but they should never be the same. But if you want to grade and regrade because there are something which is imprecise in the specification, you have to take all the copies and regrade them together. If you have some randomness inside, then you have marks that go up and down, and this is clearly not something to do with the students. No global dependencies. The first year we had something like, if you answer this question, there is a bonus of 1 point if you are between among the 10 best copies or the 10 fastest copies of the whole group. Then that means that you have to grade any all the students, of course, and then to compare all of them to determine which are the 10 best or 10 fastest ones. But if you regrade and the order change, you are stuck. Okay, so no global dependencies too. So you have a copy, you grade it independently of all of the copies. We use it on many languages. You see Bash, Make, C, Ada, JavaScript. We also use it in a course in a client server programmation with Perl, PHP, asking for pages or serving pages. And also we use it with Java. Java is simpler because we have a notion of interfaces. So you just have questions like implement this interface. And we have a version of GUnit saying that, counting not only the number of succeeding tests, but the number of succeeding assertions. So we have a more detailed, in fact, view of the test that checked. Okay, that's good. So here is the technical framework, and we just get the student file. We have a script that grade an aspect of something. So we have a script testing the test one in the question one. It just produces a log, which is an XML file. You have all the tests 1, 2, and 3 for the question one, which are gathered in a concatenation of log. You have a prelude and a postlude, which is related to a question. And then, of course, you have the same thing with the questions, the different questions.
and you just concatenate all the different logs from questions with a prelude and a postlude. And from this XML file, you just have to derive a beautiful HTML version and some SQL files to input into the database of the university with a box, of course. So, grading automatically is possible. The students have a mitigated acceptance. The reason is that good students say, well, it's fair, it's computer science, so if I'm examined on my computer skills, it's fair. And we have a number of students that say, well, it's not fair to be checked by a machine, because of course, machine is dumb, etc. The real reason is, if I miss a semicolon somewhere, and you grade it by hand, or exactly, more exactly, by eye, you will not see it, okay? But the machine will see it. So the machine is really harsh, really harsher than the man. Okay, so that's the most important problem with students. So after that, you just explain to them that if they are at the workplace, and their boss say, well, your program is good at one semicolon close, they will probably be fired. And it's probably easier to be test on that kind of thing at the university because there is no punishment. The main problem is with colleagues, because to write such exercise is a huge investment. Not only you have to write the terms of a problem, of course, everybody does, you have to be very precise in the specifications, which not everybody has. You have to write a solution, just to clarify the fact that there is a solution. So here, clearly, most colleagues are not there. And then, you have to write the grader. And this is not a piece of cake. Even if you have libraries with common things, the grader must be very, very carefully designed. And so this is a very meticulous preparation. And currently, it took me around 2 hours per question in order to make all these things together. So it's a huge investment, but it's an investment for the future. Because as I said, these are dynamic persistent analysis. And if you want to do e-learning and so on, you must have a basis for that. So here are the conclusions. First, you can use computer to teach computer science. Okay, students love to test. It's the basis for distant learning, and we have very elaborate quizzes. And these are the future works. So I'm currently in a sabbatical term, and I intend, in fact, to design some grammars to describe an exercise, the terms, the different solutions, the grader, and so on and so on, in order to be able to deploy very easily an exercise on an exercise platform. I want also, in fact, to describe a protocol for exercise submission. This allows you, for instance, to grab something into Eclipse, for instance, and say, well, I just type some program, I have a button which say, let's submit this program to the automatic grading server, and then get the result. So these are the works of my term.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Yeah.
So what you describe, things like contracts and test cases and short descriptions and possible enforcement of language dialect, that sounds a lot more like Matthias Felleisen's other design programs than it sounds like SICP. Is there anything that you disagree? Is there anything where you disagree with Matthias or where you experience that's been different from his?
In fact, when we did it, it was in 2000, and Matthias was just implementing the BSAC, and we were concurrent at the time. Satisfied with the four different languages, the beginner, almost beginner, I don't know. We have a different language, and at that time it was not easy to graft a new language in a Dr. Scheme, I would say, 100 or very old version. But clearly the goals were the same with respect to the dialect. What we add here is the automatic grading process.
So that sounds really like a fourth pillar, right? I mean, Matthias came up with this notion that it's really not enough to use Scheme, right? And
sure.
SICP doesn't really work that way that well as an introductory computer science book. And that you also need a programming environment, and that you need a didactic approach, all of which you've got, and you've also got this automatic grading. And that jives very well with our experience in tuning.
Sure.
And coincidentally, we also have trouble with his language levels, so
yeah,
we need to talk more.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oscar? Okay. I have the impression that with such a grading system, what you actually teach the students is to be able to program against specifications, very strict specifications.
Yes.
But it's my impression that in the industry, you rarely have good specifications at all.
Yes, but you...
And or to put it more positively, I think the important part in industry is that you do the creative part well, that you can come up with good specifications. How do you cover that?
Yeah, that's true. Here we have, in the Scheme course, which is the first introductory course, we just give small problems to the students. They are clearly specified because they are small problems. The interesting fact is that we do black box testing, because black box testing will be, in fact, the professional skill you will have in some companies. You have black box testing. So, of course, they won't have a very precise specification in companies, but they have black box testing, the same kind of things. So it's a half or an answer.
And also, not all of the students are going to be computer scientists.
Sure.
So they're not necessary.
Yeah.
I believe Nick or his neighbor was as
yeah.
wish. Let's talk to us briefly about plagiarism.
In fact, we have two solutions. The first one is that we have a global dependency where we check plagiarism. But we check plagiarism only when we give some homeworks. For examinations which are done in the computer rooms, there is no plagiarism because the machine are reconfigured, no talk, no export display, and so on and so on. So we only check for homeworks. So the technique is known now, I think. I use it in 98. You just take the files of students, the files on other students, you compress the file of the first students with JZIP, you compress the files of the other students, okay, you get a number, and then you just concatenate the two and you compress the two, the concatenation. If the concatenation is far less than the sum of the two JZIP things, then there is something. In fact, the idea is not from me, because I heard it in a computer science conference where there was a guy which was talking of register color allocation or something like that. And what he did, I don't remember exactly, something like that.
I was thinking about just understanding which language of text was in by compressing it with that number.
Yeah, he compressed the traces. And he said, well, if the politic of replacement of cache is good, then the compression should be good. And I said, got it. For plagiarism, it's the same idea. In fact, we have, of course, smart students. And what we do now is to pass through an obfuscator that renames all the variables consistently, okay, with the same verb. And then we just compare the two obfuscated code programs, okay? Because we rename the same thing. You know, we have many students that just rename a variable or a method. You just obfuscate the two, and you get the same name.
We have time for one more question. Okay. My question is also far from this one. Do you have any attempts of students trying to hack your grader?
To hack?
Your grader.
We don't observe them, but but in fact we run the grader on a very very confined machine which can only be attacked from the outside without any daemons, etc., etc. The interesting question is that we put all this code in GPL, so we have in fact the whole source code. So we. There is a problem of clearly how to protect these kind of things and this, making it available through GPL. For instance, in Dr. Scheme,
The solution appears when you have a mark over some threshold. So the solution is somewhere. So we crypt the solution with a very simple XOR. But some students, very smart, just look at the code, see the XOR stuff, and just decode all the solutions. So the other solution was, in fact, to creep with a private key and so on and so on. But it takes us too far. You just have to have one course ahead of the students, of the smart
students. These students shouldn't have their license anyway.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. But they were good enough for that.
They were in the first year, so no way.
Okay, thank you very much.